Welcome to Exploration 1, Lecture 5. I think we're up to Lecture 5. Is everybody's count of lectures that we're up to at 5? I think mine is, anyway. I know we're still doing Chapter 4 and stuff, but this is actually Lecture 5. Okie dokie. Now, the first thing we wanted to cover was the Apache configuration files. I should probably... Do you guys want the speech and stuff from this? Because it will only take me, like, 7 seconds to set up. Oh, I certainly can. I now have 3 audio repeaters running faster than you can say thank you, Tyler. Oh, the other thing I also have from Tyler, which I've got to read through the code, but I'm sure it's safe, is a Braille and Speak emulator for eSpeak. So you basically fire this thing up, attach it to COM to COM, and then you put one side of the COM port on your virtual machine and the other side on your computer, and you end up with a Braille and Speak for your virtual DOS boxes. So if anybody wants to play with that, they're welcome. It's kind of cool.
Oh, I'd play with that. I used to use one of those in, like, grade school. Those things, I love my Braille and Speak.
Well, this is just an emulator for the synth, so it's not actually the emulator of the whole device. So what it is it's just the synthesizer, so you can run ASAP in a DOS virtual machine or Vocalize or Flipper and actually have speech on your computer inside a DOS virtual machine. So, kind of cool.
Oh, yeah. Oh, even still, I could think of a couple applications for that. Useful.
Okay, let's see if I can break things and get this to work.
Are those old DOS screen readers available anywhere? I know some places were still trying to sell them, but are they obtainable from anywhere?
Yeah, I'd like to know too, actually.
Apart from your esteemed instructor having most of them, there is actually a history project that's got them all. So you still can get ASAP, you still can get Flipper. ASAP and Flipper are also on the what is now a mirror of the Simtel 20 software repository. I think it's now done by Walnut Creek, but if you do a search for Simtel 20, you'll find it. It used to be on oak.oakland.edu, but it's now mirrored. Am I coming through, by the way?
You are. Simtel 20, like S-I-M-T-E-L 20, or is it two L's?
No, it's just one L. It was actually an old military collection of software. They used to, back in the early 90s, they made this incredible CD, or double CD set. It became of just these hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of DOS programs. And I've actually still got a CD set. And it was, I don't know, from the days of floppy disk, when I first saw a CD with 600 meg of little programs that were like, you know, half a meg in size, that was all my Christmases come at once. But that's not relevant to what we're doing at the moment. There. I'm just trying to remember which,
Menu setup button.
Aha. Okay, have you guys got... There's Jaws.
There it is.
I like it when these setups work. If anybody wants the auto IT script and bits and pieces to do this, let me know, and I will give it to you. It's very cool.
Windows and desktop folder.
All right, so we want to go into the remote bundle. I've got too many icons on my desktop, sue me.
Enter.
Actually, no, don't. I don't have the money.
168, period. 100, period.
Now, I'm going in as a local IP, which is 144. You're going in to www.qcat.org. Telnet, as poor Barry found out the other day. You got to Telnet in, because unfortunately SSH takes you into the main QCAT server. I had been tempted to move the SSH of the main QCAT server off into no man's land, but I thought I might confuse people connecting to it, so I hadn't actually done that. But it was very tempting.
144, tab, history, check, box, check, tab, SSH, radio, button, check, telnet, radio, button, check, 103, alt, plus, enter, terror, term, match, left, bracket, disconnected, right, bracket, TT, highlighted, setup, control, window, resize, help.
Okay, let's go in.
Post, D, star, 1, center, port status, cold version, 3.0, side ID, colon, tab, bundle, port, vertical bar, name, vertical bar, pass. Root, dot, enter, slash, H, for, land, 0, 5, vertical bar, WKS, 1, vertical bar, left, pair.
Alright, let's go in there. Slash, C5.
Slash, C5, enter, connected, 0, 5, colon, WKS, 1, disconnect, enter, colon, carry, T. Enter 11.9.10 WKS1 ISO WKS1 login colon. Copy enter password colon. Copy enter last login colon object 5101932 WST 2011 ISO WKS1 2.6.31-19-0-K number 56-2SMP2Jan2829. Enter
okay.
Object WKS1 colon tilde dollar.
Now if we look at city etc. Apache.
Enter Apache 2. LS enter Apache 2.conf enable sites available conf.http.conf.
Okay, what you've actually got here.
Apache 2.conf. Enter. 8097.
There's stuff in Apache.conf. What's everybody on about?
No, it wanted you to look at the default web page for the Apache server, which is, I believe, the index file in /var/www.
Yeah, I interpreted it as the file they wanted you to look at was httpd.conf, unless I totally off on that, which apparently I was.
I think that's right. The lab does say httpd.
Okay, let's have a look. We don't use httpd.conf in recent versions of Apache. How the configuration file actually works now, and this isn't actually directly relevant to exploration, but I'll mention it because you might come across it if you're doing shared hosting. But if I look here, there's stuff
here. Enter number based upon the NCSA server configuration file originally by Rob McCool. Enter number is the main Apache server configuration file that contains the enter number configuration directives active the server's instructions.
Hey, that sounds good to me. That's sort of what I wanted you to look at. I'm using ed to hit enter to go through that, but I mean, obviously, you guys might want to use something else. I will hack about those labs and change those a little bit.
Enter number C, http://http.apache.org/.2.2/ for detailed information about.
Oh, yeah, and if you actually go to that website, it really does have detailed information about that.
Enter object WKS1
Let's have a look what's in this directory.
Source enter apache2.com. Root dot cursor. Site stash enabled. Sites available.
Okay, so what you've got in this directory, you've got sites enabled and sites available, which we're not covering directly, but sites available are the websites that you've got that you can actually have, which are like your virtual hosts, because you can actually have more than one website on a particular machine bound to one IP. So you can have www.makelotsofmoney.com.au, and then you can have a virtual host for www.makeevenmoremoney.com.au, and www.getreallyrichquick.com.au you can all be hosted on the same server on the same IP. And the way the HTTP server knows which page to hand out is by looking at the host header that is handed in by the browser, because the browser says host http://makemoneyquick.com.au. Okay, that isn't relevant to exploration, but it's interesting in its own right. And what you do is you have sites available, which are all the ones you can have, and sites enabled are the ones that you're actually using now. And there's actually an E2N site and E2 disk site that turns the sites on and off. Okay.
Ports.conf
is which ports the web server is listening on, so you can look in there and look at the ports.
Mods enabled.
The mods enabled is the same for the mods enabled and
mods available.
And mods available are the same for the modules that are loaded in by the web server.
Magic
lets it identify different file types by looking at magic numbers.
HTTP.conf,
which was probably the one I wanted you to look at, which, if I believe correctly, should be empty.
Members.
And the readme says it should
conf.
Be. Let's have a look.
File, http://http.conf.
Oh, it really is empty. So that's why it came up with... which is why it came up with the end just by itself, because if we do that, we just get... There we are. There's Corey's behavior. HTTP.conf is deprecated, which is the programmer's way of saying we don't use it anymore. And
70s.
Basically, everything is done in Apache.conf, and you can put things in httpd.conf that override what's in Apache.conf, but you really shouldn't because it breaks all the configuration set up for the web server. So I'll edit that lab, and you can all go look at Apache.conf. How's that sound? Is anybody still awake?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it sounds good.
Okay. The problem is we don't teach Apache in these courses, so a lot of our students are really against installing Apache on their local system, and I wanted to try and get a method of doing the lab where you didn't have to install Apache on your local system to be able to do the particular labs or whatever. So that's sort of the complexity. So you want Apache.conf. Does that answer your question, Corey, to any degree?
Yeah, I think the main problem is I was looking at the wrong configuration file, which Yeah, and again, just to clarify, how do you get a directory listing under Linux? Is it just DIR, like under DOS? Or?
No, it's LS for list sorted.
LS. Okay.
Is there a...
Enter, left there, and right there, left, Q, obvious, W, dir, enter, apache2.conf, vars.
Oh, there's a dir alias. What's dir do? Which dir?
Dir, enter, slash, bin, slash, dir, obvious, W, KS1, colon, slash.
Ah, there is actually an alias for DIR in case you do want to use it. Now, the other thing I keep telling people is, remember those virtual machines I was talking about that you can get from the QCAT website? They've actually got the ability to go /dwww, and you can actually get in and read all of the documentation for all of the different things that are installed, and that includes Apache. So if you want an easy way to read all of the documentation for Linux stuff, including all the man pages, documents, and info files in a web browser, grab the virtual machine off QCAT and point your browser at the IP of the virtual machine /dwww. We're not saying that you've got unlimited time to do that, but if you do want to read the docs, it's far easier than reading the man pages at the terminal.
Title is 192.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.2.
because I'm actually sitting on a workstation. Oh, hang on, I know what I can do. So we're going sudo su. And you give Cavi's password again. And you go tcp dump.
ARP.
Hey, it works! Actually, I should be able to listen to anything on that interface because it's a fairly quiet interface. Let's have a look. There we go, guys. Oops, I'll stop that. That's the spanning tree protocol from the Cisco switches. They're announcing themselves. Ah, you can't believe how happy I am that that TCP dump stuff still works. Okay, anything else people want me to show them while I'm in here before I switch back to regular mic input and take the voice out of the equation?
Well, Gary, it's Jason. I had a question. Do you need to do sudo su, or can you just do sudo space TCP dump and then the command line, and then just the arguments to it?
I'm a bit lazy and I'm old school, so I do sudo su so that all of the commands I execute from that point on are done as a super user. Technically, you're supposed to do sudo tcp dump, blah blah blah, but usually I'm messing around as the super user. And yes, I have deleted piles of my files with an invalid RM in the past, so I have had my fingers burnt, but sudo su will keep you in the super user until you explicitly exit the shell.
That's okay, I deleted my old dev directory one time.
Oh, I deleted slash user. That was bad. Luckily, my friend had a backup of it on another hard drive, and I just lent them the hard drive, and I rang them up and said, can you please bring that hard drive back over? I need my USR directory back, and I actually still had slash bin slash CP, so I could actually copy it back into place. But I can assure you, there were some nail-biting moments there for a minute.
Kerry?
Yes?
You're not in chat, and Matthew was asking for...
Oh! Right, hang on. Alright, I'm in chat now. Sorry, Matthew, did you want to say something? Or, I'm sorry, I should have opened my chat window. My bad.
Oh, no worries. It's I was wondering if it was only slightly relevant, but then you brought it up first, so that was very helpful of you. I'm very interested in doing the virtual machine so I can take advantage of the slash DWWW, but I can't get it to work in the VMware player. I can't switch the network setting into bridged mode, which I believe is required, so that I'll get an IP for the virtual machine. I reached out to discuss for help, but I don't think anyone knew what to do. I was assuming you have to change those settings while your VM isn't running, like all the other settings, but it won't change in player. I wonder if that's a limitation.
I will look into that for you. Basically, if you leave it in NAT mode, it will actually get a machine that... It'll actually get an address that is valid from the machine you're currently working on. So you can still use it in NAT mode in player. It just means you'll only be able to access the machine from the host that you're working on. So what you do is you boot the machine and then you look in vnet.dhcp leases, and it comes up. Oh, you can edit the VMX too, which was the other thing I was going to say. Yes, Jason?
Just for Matthew, one of the things you want to make sure in VMware Player, because I have been able to change that setting, you've got to make sure the VM is not suspended. It has to be actually powered off, I think. If it's in what it calls suspend mode or whatever, I don't think you can edit that stuff.
Yes, he's absolutely right. It must be completely shut down. So you must do a shutdown-h now on the Linux virtual machine as the root to actually shut it down completely. If you just close out of it, it'll suspend.
Yeah, and I would expect that. I'm more familiar with, what's it called, Fusion on the Mac. I use that more. But I'll triple-check and make sure, because I would... If that's the case, then I know why it's not working. But when I looked at the menu bar at the top, it said that it was powered off. But I didn't explicitly give the commands in the Linux system to shut it down. I let VMware Player do it. Maybe it's not the same.
No, it's not. VMware Player can't shut down a host operating system. You've got to shut the host down inside the host. It doesn't shut down the guest operating system. You have to shut down the virtual machine itself. If you tell VMware Player to shut it down, you either end up with an unclean shutdown or you end up with a suspend. So if you go power off in VMware Player, that's like pressing the power button on a computer. It can be done, but it's not recommended.
Very good. I'll sort it out. I don't want to take any more time on it, but thanks for that. I want to take advantage of the Slick Docs interface, since you told me about it. I think it'll speed up learning how to get better with Ed and other tools.
Oh, it certainly will. The other thing to keep in mind is even if it is NATed, if you look in that vnet.dhcp leases, it'll just have like a 192.168.174.128 address, and if you connect to that from the machine you're working on, it will actually allow you to access the documentation. If you change it so that it is bridged, it can then be accessed from any machine on your network, which gives you more fun and flexibility. But it's not officially required to complete the source, but I always find it more convenient for it to get a real IP on my network so that I can connect to it from multiple boxes and serve out little test web pages and silliness like that. So that's the thinking behind that.
All right, thanks for that.
Alrighty, let's get back to some of the course material. Although this lab discussion is very valid. Shall we start talking a little bit, before we get into Chapter 4 on the transport layer, shall we start talking about IP addresses and stuff this week? It seems as though we're about up to that, I think.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, I'm just going to flick back away from this...
context menu, option, submenu, tandem, submenu, oh, Windows default, sound card, W.
Let's do that, and then I've just got to change my input audio device so that we can get rid of the cables, and then I can kill off the repeaters. I'm back. There we are. Now, and if anybody hasn't played with NUtils, you really should. I know I flog this every week, but it is really cool and it's under extras.
I'll second that. It's excellent.
It's sort of one of those functions that you really wish was in Windows by default. Well, it kind of is with Windows 7, but it is nice to have the... the noises and things to tell you what's going on.
So, this isn't too off topic. One of the things I was curious about with NUtils, can I have NUtils or something set up so that when I launch something, it brings up a whole series of windows and automatically hides them? Like, I want, you know, three different browser sessions open and, you know, a couple other things and then automatically hides them. Can it do that?
I'm not sure. I would do that with auto IT and then tell nutils to hide it with auto IT. I don't think nutils has the smarts to actually bring stuff up and hide it. It does have the smarts to auto hide Windows, but I think you'd actually have to use some auto IT magic to actually bring the stuff up and hide them. But I'll look into that for you.
Yeah, right, nutils I think you might be right, able to do that. It can kill things for you automatically, and it can hide things automatically, but it can't bring them up.
Alrighty. Let's get in here. Alright, let's start talking about IP addresses and stuff, because that's probably worth worth discussing. Bits and pieces like that. Now, has everybody... I haven't actually gone down all the way down to the bottom of my email. Has some people attempted the first binary exercise? Because I've been meaning to look down through my email to see if any of those have...
Jason, I've poked at it, but I haven't sent anything in yet.
Okay, well, that's all right. It's not the end of the world. Is everybody relatively cool with the binary procedure that we went through last week and the week before? Unfortunately, practicing is the only way to get really good at it, which is unfortunate. All the things in life tend to be like that.
Yeah, I would say so. The only trouble I had with that assignment, and still kind of fighting with, is at the bottom where you have to AND all those numbers, and then it has to do something with the gateway and compare it and see if it's in the network or outside it. I don't quite understand that, but the actual binary conversions, I, for one, understand.
Ah, well, I haven't taught you about that yet, so I'm not expecting you to know that, because we haven't spoken about ANDing and all that sort of stuff yet. I haven't spoken about IP addresses, so I don't actually expect you to know how that works.
Oh, good. Okay. Can I hand this thing in to you as it is, then, with the bottom not done, or...?
Yeah, sure, if you want me to check over the top bit.
Okay.
I didn't know you were expecting that one, Kerry. Maybe I misunderstood. I know you told us to pull it down and have a look at it, but I wasn't. I didn't understand you wanted us to do it and send it to you.
Oh, I do, but I want it by like module 6. It was like pull it down and have a look at it because you are eventually going to do it, and as I teach you different things, it's going to get to the point where you can actually do that exercise.
Got it. Thanks.
Oh, okay. I'll just cool on it then for a while.
Yeah, I'm sort of expecting that to come in by, like, module 6 or so, when you guys sort of understand how the binary stuff works. They're actually exercises written as an extension to sort of flesh out the exercises that were in the chapter, and they came from the old CCNA when I used to teach CCNA. Students found them quite helpful, and especially the one with busy builders was fairly practical, so people had an idea as to how we did this subnetting and why we did it that way. So the eventual thought is for you guys to actually complete those exercises by module 6 or so. Alrighty, let's start talking about IP addresses for the moment so you guys can understand how these IP addresses work and how we write them and all that sort of stuff. I mean, most of you have seen IP addresses before. Anybody tell me how many bits in an IP address?
32.
Anybody else? Everybody happy with 32? I'm happy with 32.
Yeah, agreed with 32.
So if we take your average IP address like this, except I can't type 192.168.1.1 if you're listening to the recording, you will notice that it is split into four sections. The 192, the 168, the 1, and the 1. And each of those... Who's just turned up? And each of those sections are 4 bytes separated by full stops. And if you have 4 bytes, you have 4 by 8 bits, and you have 32 bits. Everybody happy with that much so far?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, say for example you had an IP address of 192.192.192.192. Would everybody agree that if we were writing that out in binary, it would be 11123456, 11123456, Does that follow? Because 128 and 64 is 192, obviously, which is why I picked it, because it was easy. But you can convert 192.192.192.192 to double one six zeros, double one six zeros, double one six zeros, double one six zeros, and that would be how we would convert that IP address into binary.
Makes sense.
Yeah, I get it.
Okay, so now, when you look at an IP address, an IP address by itself doesn't mean a huge amount. It tells you what an individual machine is numbered on a network, and the IP address exists at the networking layer of the OSI reference model, so we are looking at layer 3, which is the network layer. And if you look at the IP address on your average home router, it's 192.168.1.1, and it's, well, if unless you've got a link system, it's 192.168.1.254. Okay, but each machine has to have a unique IP address unless you're hiding them behind NAT, which I'll talk about later. And these IP addresses are either assigned manually by the administrator via DHCP, via BootP, or via RARP. Are we all happy with that much so far?
Yeah.
Maybe a small question.
Yeah, sorry, you got a question?
Yeah, just maybe a curiosity more than anything, or maybe it'll come later, but the routers that I'd worked with in the past, the home ones, are, as you said, they almost always had that same default address. But I picked up one of Apple's time capsules here about a year ago with the onboard hard drive for backups. It's kind of nifty. And that one starts off at 10.0.1.1 instead. I wondered if that's significant or something I should care about, of why they do it differently than the Linksys.
Well, that's Apple being difficult, pretty much. They can't have 192 like everybody else. They've got to have something different. But we'll talk about... I'll very, very briefly talk about this. Basically, if you look up the RFC of assigned numbers, and I think it's RFC 1918... but don't quote me on that, because I might have the number wrong, ironically enough. There are a number of ranges of IP addresses that are allocated for non-routable traffic. In other words, traffic that should not be routed on the internet. Now, eventually you should know all of these ranges, but I'm not expecting you to know them all today. But you will learn to recognize them and see them and go, that's non-routable. Okay, so there are... One, Class A network at 10.0.0.0/8. And yes, I will talk about Class A networks in a minute. Oh, here we are. They're testing the alarm systems. So apparently I have to not evacuate now. There are 16 Class B networks from 172.16/16 to 172.31. And there are 254 Class Cs from 192.168.0 to 192.168.254. Has anybody seen any of these addresses before? 10. Dot blah, 172.16, 192.168?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So the rules on the internet are that you are not to route those three sets of blocks on the internet. You're supposed to drop them at your routers. My experience is they make it through about three or four routers before being ditched, like about five hops upstream. But it's good to know that everybody follows those rules. But yeah, you're not supposed to route that stuff over the internet because they are internal use only. So, okay, we'll start by talking about classful routing. Back in the early days of the internet, we had classful routing. For an IP address, to figure out how big the network an IP address is put on, you have an IP address and you have a subnet mask. What's the matter? Didn't bring them over here. You didn't bring any in here. You 29 something or others. You'd offered a couple to me and then you said no, you were selling them, so I never saw them. Yeah, I still want them. Yeah, okay, good. Sorry, we're just scabbing up some more switches. Okay, we're done now. So you have an IP address and you have a subnet mask. Has everybody seen a subnet mask that's 255.255.255.0? If you haven't, I don't know why you're in this course, but everybody should have seen that subnet mask before?
Yeah.
Alrighty. Now, basically, the subnet mask, an IP address is broken into two portions. One portion is the network address, and the other portion is the host portion. Okay, and I'll define those in a minute. The network address tells you which network you're on, and the host address tells you which host on that network. So if we take 192.168.1.1, which is a pretty standard IP address, and we take a subnet mask of 255.255.255.0, in very basic terms at this point, the subnet mask tells you that 24 bits of the address are part of the network, hence the 255.255.255, and the .0, which is another 8 bits, is a portion of the host network, of the host portion. So 192.168.1.1 with a subnet mask of 255.255.255.0 is actually host 192, is host number 1 on the 192.168.1 network. Any questions, clarifications, confusion?
No, I think I've got you so far.
Now, if you have 192.168.1.25, that is host number 25 on the 192.168.1 network, okay? Because the 255.255.255.0 says that there are 24 bits for the network portion, and there are 8 bits for the host portion. This is known as a Class C network. So, back in the old days, we had Class A networks, which were 255.0.0.0, Class Bs, which are 255.255.0.0, and Class Cs, which are 255.255.255.0. So A, B, and C, 1, 2, and 3, 255s, if you want to remember it that way. Now, yes?
I just want to make sure I understand. So basically, that determines the number of hosts, so therefore, on an 8-bit network, because you can only go up to 255, with 8 bits, that's how many hosts you can have. But if it was, say, a 16-bit network, then you could have a 16-bit value for how many hosts you could have on that network. Is that kind of how?
Actually, the other way around, right? So if you've got a Class A network, you've got 1 byte for network portion and 3 bytes for hosts. So you can have 16.7 million hosts. The formula is actually 2 to the power of h minus 2, where h is the number of host bits. So 2 to the power of 24 minus 2 is how many hosts you could have. Just give me a second. Are you messing with that machine, are you, Sumit?
Yes.
Here, have a thumb drive with GRML so you can find the live file system. I made one yesterday.
Thanks.
Right. So, if you have a subnet mask of 255.255.0.0, you have 16 bits for the network portion and 16 bits for the host portion. 2 to the power of 16 minus 2 is 65,534 hosts. If you have 255.255.255.0, you have 24 bits for the network and 8 bits for the host. The number of hosts you can have is 2 to the power of 8 minus 2, or 254 hosts. So, you were kind of round the wrong way, but does that kind of make more sense now? Well, this bit anyway.
I think so. But basically, the last portion on the subnet determines how many hosts that can have. I guess, just to clarify.
The subnet mask has to have all ones on the left and all zeros on the right if you convert it into binary, and the number of zeros it has on the right tells you how many host bits you can have, and the number of ones on the left tells you how many network bits you can have.
Okay.
Now, obviously, when you have Class A, B, and C networks, if you have a Class A network and it's got 16.7 million hosts, it can be very wasteful to allocate Class A networks to various hosts. Because obviously somebody will have 16.7 million hosts and they can't actually do that. Just give me 5 seconds, guys. I've just got to tell this guy something before he wastes his entire morning. I'll be back.
What you have to do...
A true multitasker.
I'll throw this in here. I mean, why do you guys, and most of you guys probably know this, but why would that be so wasteful?
Well, because I would think if you allocate a Class A network to a company and they don't use it, then that's just dead space. They can't, you can't give it out if they've been allocated that. Is that where you're going with that?
Partially, but I was more going for if you have a subnet mask and you have that many host bits open for a subnet. If you don't use that subnet if you leave a subnet open with that many host bits.
I am back.
Welcome back.
Okay, so the whole point of subnetting is breaking up networks into the right size chunks so that you have enough IP addresses to do what you want with the limited pool of IP addresses that you actually have. Which is to say, how many IP addresses do I need for this? How many IP addresses do I need for that? How many do I need for this subnet? How many do I need for that subnet? On the understanding that we are running out of IPv4 addresses, so therefore it is important to allocate our subnets correctly. That is why we subnet. We haven't got into how to subnet yet, but that's okay. So, what actually happens is anybody familiar with what an AND gate is? Apart from Nehemiah, who's already done the course, so he's exempt. He probably knows what an AND gate is. Anybody else know what an AND gate is?
I've heard the term, but I couldn't explain it back to you.
Okay, so imagine you have a bizarre watering system. And the bizarre watering system has a tap, and it has a hose, and it has two taps along the hose, and it has a sprinkler. Okay, so we've got faucet, or tap as we call them in Australia. We have two valves on the pipe, and we have a sprinkler on the end. Does it pass that unless both of the valves on the pipe are open, the kids aren't going to get wet by the sprinkler? Okay, you got to have both valves open to let the water through. Everybody kind of cool with that image?
Yep.
Well, that's an AND gate. One and one, in other words, the taps are open, is one. If this tap and the next tap is open, the water comes out the sprinkler. That's an AND gate. In its simplest form. Now, just to complicate things, has anybody seen those rooms where you walk into the room and you flick a light switch down and the lights come on? It doesn't help a lot of us here, but it does help a majority of the population. And then when you walk to the other end of the room and flick the light switch down, the lights go off. So if both switches are down or both switches are up, the lights are off. But if one switch is down and one switch is up, the lights are on. Has anyone seen that arrangement?
Yeah, I hate them.
That is called an exclusive OR gate. In other words, one or the other is on, and the output is one. But if both are on or both are off, then the output is a zero. That's actually an XOR gate. Okay, now just to finish off the Boolean stuff, just so that we've done a complete job of it. So assume you've got an OR gate. An OR gate says if one or the other is on, then or both, then the output of the gate is going to be a 1. So, say for example you have a tap with two hoses coming off it. I don't know why you'd wire it up this way, but it's just a good way of imaging it. So you've got two hoses off, and there's a tap on each hose, and then both hoses go off places and then come back and both hook into the sprinkler. So if you get water from either hose, you actually get output from the sprinkler. So that's an OR gate. Either this one, or that one, or both of them, if they're on, you are going to get an output on the gate of 1.
Oh, okay. I get it.
So, why should we care about AND gates? Well, that's a good question. You know how I keep saying that IP addresses are 32 bits long? And they're 32 bits long, and they're in binary, and they're 32 bits long, and they're in binary, and they're in binary, and they're 32 bits long. Okay, remember I said that a few times? IP addresses are in binary, subnet masks are in binary, computers work in binary. Okay. So what actually happens is you take the IP address and the subnet mask and you AND them together. How do you AND them together? You convert both of them into binary, and then you work from top to bottom, and you go 1 and 1 is 1, 1 and 1 is 1, 1 and 1 is 1, 1 and 0 is 0, 0 and 1 is 0, 1 and 1 is 1. And you actually do the ANDs. Wherever there are two 1s, you put a 1, otherwise you put a 0. That's how ANDing works. Any questions? Anybody want me to sort of clarify that more or explain it differently?
Only if you can explain it with sponge cake.
No, unfortunately not. No, I can't explain it with sponge cake. We'll have to keep that for the TCP reference model. We'll have a four-layer sponge cake. I need to duck out to take care of something up the other end of the building for 2 minutes like I usually do. Does everybody want a 2 minute, 2 to 3 minute break, and I'll come back and finish this off?
Yeah, sure.
Yep, I'll be back. Yeah, you can inhale whatever you want. I'll be back soon.
Matthew, are you there?
Sorry, what?
Oh, I was looking for Matthew. I had a question, but I just double-checked VMware player on my side, and I am seeing the bridge and NAT options. So, Nehemiah, do Cisco routers automatically not route the 192 addresses, or do you have to explicitly tell them not to?
Sorry, say that again?
Do Cisco routers automatically not route the non-routable addresses, or do you actually have to tell them not to?
I'd have to look quite honest.
Yeah, I would think it would just do it by default, but yeah, I was curious.
I'll be right back.
Jason, if you're right about that virtual machine I was fighting with, you'll win a gold star.
I just checked on mine. I've got a couple of Linux virtual machines. They're not the ones that from Cavi, they're ones I built. And I was able to go into settings. You arrow down to the virtual machine, do a control D to go into settings, and if I go to network, I do see the bridged NAT, options there, so.
Yeah, then that's got to be it. No, I don't have the, whatever it is that's up there, Edge Stable or whatever. No, I pulled down the current Vinix so that I could, as long as I'm at it, I might as well be able to have a peek at the GUI stuff, or at least that of it that works, and check that out as well.
It's actually quite good, the GUI. I haven't played... I mean, I've done some work with it, but I'm still a command line guy, so I still like the command line stuff.
Okay, I'm back.
Kerry, I had a question as Jason. A question I thought about. Do Cisco routers automatically not route the non-routable addresses, or do you have to actually tell them not to?
You tell them. They don't automatically do anything. You're the administrator. You have to tell them.
Okay, I wasn't sure. Like, I thought because it was a standard, it might just do it, but I didn't know.
Hang on. No. If you did that, like, imagine if you didn't route the non-routable subnets and you had internal addressing inside an organization that worked on the 192.168 subnet, that'd be bad. You wouldn't be able to use your Cisco.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Everybody else back? Have we had our smoke breaks and everything?
Yep.
Okay, so we talked about how the AND worked, and you'll notice in extras there is a thing called JAWS notepad scripts, and you're going to ask yourself, what do they do? They make it so that JAWS only reads the current character when you go up and down by line rather than reading the whole line, which can make it easier for some people to be able to do binary because it doesn't read out the whole numbers when you go up and down by lines.
I wonder if Excel would work like that too. Would you be able to do that? Like put each number in a cell in Excel?
I know people who have. Pranav certainly puts numbers in Excel and does that. It is a bit tricky to type them in because you've got to go one tab, one tab, one tab, and it can get a bit messy, but it can be done.
Hi, it's me giving you a call. Call me back.
Okay.
Okay, so say for example you have, so the whole thing with subnetting, so we've got class A's, class B's, class C's. This meant that you can have addresses with 16.7 million, addresses with 65,536, and subnets with 256 addresses. Now, there are actually two reserved addresses. Okay, so we're all cool with the idea that the subnet is broken into network portion and host portion. Everybody cool with that? We have a network portion and we have a host portion. And the number of network bits is set by the subnet mask, and it doesn't have to be a multiple of 8. Alright, because what I'm going to say now may complicate things a little bit, but we'll see how we go. So let's assume we have a subnet, an IP address of 192.168.1.1, and we have a subnet mask of 255.255.255.0. There are two ways of writing subnet masks. One is 255.255.255.0, and the other is /24. This is called CIDR notation, and stands for classless inter-domain routing. And it tells you the number of bits in the network portion. So 255.255.255.0 is the same as /24. 255.255.0.0 is the same as /16. 255.0.0.0 is the same as /8.
What's that acronym again, Kieran?
CIDR. Here it is. How's that? You can even copy and paste it into your notes if that would be less typing. CIDR, classless inter-domain routing.
I saw some of that notation already in labs or someplace. I think it was the labs and had no idea what it meant. Now I do.
Well, we try not to teach you too many things in lecture, but we try to get a couple of things across. Okay, so say for example we have an IP address of 192.168.1.1, and we have a subnet mask of 255.255.255.0. Now obviously people have seen that in various places. In fact, I think internet connection sharing under recent Windows uses those ranges. So, everybody cool with those numbers that we're going to work with at the moment? 192.168.1.1, subnet mask of /24 or 255.255.255.0?
Yeah.
We are all going to agree that the first 3 bytes are the network portion and the last byte is the host portion because of the subnet mask. It says so. We cool with that?
Yep.
I can debug that with him anyway, Gross, because I've got his... We can debug it remotely anyway. I'd say it's his Outlook junk filtering them. Okay, so the thing you've got to remember about TCP/IP networks is there are two special addresses on every TCP/IP subnet. One is known as the network address, and that is where all of the host bits are set to zero. And the other is known as the broadcast address, which is where all of the host bits are set to 1. So on our sample network, 192.168.1.0 is our network address because all of the host bits are set to 0. And 192.168.1.255 is the broadcast address, which is where all of our host bits are set to 1.
Makes sense.
Should he get a Gmail? Sumit. Yeah, that might work better.
There's no issue with his email. I think that kind of got something wrong.
Okay, because Hotmail has trouble delivering, getting emails from Linux boxes on a regular occasion.
Okay, because he was able to get both of ours.
Yeah, but it's flaky.
Okay.
Okay, so if... So, The network address refers to the whole network. So 192.168.1.0 is the entire 192.168.1 network. That is important when you are doing routing. That is important if you want to send things to a particular network. The broadcast address sends a message to every machine on a particular network. So if you send a packet to 192.168.1.255, all machines on the 192.168.1 network will receive that packet. So remember earlier when I said that to find out how many hosts you could have on a network, it was 2 to the power of h minus 2, where h was the number of host bits. The reason it's minus 2 is because you need to take off that network address and that broadcast address.
So isn't it true that if you ping a broadcast address on a network, all the machines on that subnet will respond? Is that right?
It depends on how the machines are configured. By default, all of the machines will respond if you ping the broadcast address, unless an administrator has gone through and disabled the reply to broadcast pings. Some network management software expects every machine to respond if you ping a broadcast, but that can be used to launch attacks such as Smurf and stuff, so many administrators actually turn that functionality off.
And the purpose of the network address is simply to identify the entire network.
That is correct. So let's run a scenario here. Let's assume for some odd reason that's my muffin. You can have it if you want. Okay. Say for example we had two housemates, Bob and Jill, are living in a house together. I should make it Alice and Bob just to be security about it, okay? But Alice doesn't trust Bob, and Bob doesn't trust Alice. So what they've got is they've got this router that was set up by Jim. Actually, it should be set up by Charlie. Okay, so it's set up by Charlie. The router is set up by Charlie. And Charlie has said 192.168.1.0 to 192.168.1.127 belongs to Alice. And 192.168.128 to 192.168.255 belongs to Bob. So can you see that the network is split in half?
Yes.
And it so happens on this network that the subnet mask is 255.255.255.128. Because you actually have 25 bits for the host and 25 bits for the network, let me say the right things, and 7 bits for the host. So Alice and Bob have actually done is they've split the network in half. They have a router routing to both networks. So Alice's network is 192.168.1.0 and Bob's network is 192.168.1.128. So they both have their own network segment and the router is responsible for controlling network traffic between the networks. Has anybody got any questions with it?
Yeah, I thought I had it, but then when you said that it's the .0 address is on Alice's side, I thought that the .0 indicated both halves of the same network.
Ah, but you're assuming the subnet mask on their network is 255.255.255.0. .0 is only the network address of his network if all of the host bits, as far as the subnet mask is concerned, are set to 0. And that's only true if it's 192.168.1.0 with 255.255.255.0. A lot of people get into the habit of thinking .0 is always the network address. Not true.
No, that's just plain tricky, but I understand.
Okay, so let's break this down a bit further to try and make it easier, which it might not, but we'll do it anyway. So say, for example, we've got Alice, Bob, and Charlie got chucked out of where he lives, so he's moved in with Alice and Bob as well, because he's the network guy, and Daryl has moved in with them as well. So we've got Alice, Bob, Charlie, and Daryl, okay? They all don't really trust each other. They're all just hanging out because rent's so expensive in California. And we have now split the network into four sections. So we've got 192.168.1.0. We have a network address of 250. Well, the SuperNet has got a subnet mask of 255.255.255.0. And we have 256 addresses on our subnet. If we split the network into four, how many addresses will each person get if we have 256 divided by four? Feel free to use a calculator. 64 each?
Six.
Alrighty, so say for example this network has been split into four segments and we've got 64 addresses each, alright? Does it follow that Alice is 0 to 63? Bob is 64 to 95? Charlie, hang on. Yeah, yeah. No, I'm out by an order of magnitude. No, I'm not. Okay, it's good. So, Alice is 0 to 63, Bob is 64 to 128, Charlie is 129 to 191, and Daryl is 192 to 255. Can anybody kind of see how that works? I know it'll be easier if I write it out in a text file, but I'm just talking about it at the moment.
Yeah, that makes sense. I don't get how you calculate the subnet mask for that yet, but I'm sure you're going there.
Oh, yes, I am.
And each of those four segments will have its own network and broadcast address, correct?
That's exactly right. Alice's network address is .0. Her broadcast is 63. Bob's network address is 64. Bob's broadcast is 95. Charlie's is 96 to... Oh, hang on, I've goofed it. 0 to 64, sorry. So it's 0 to 63 is Alice. 64 to 127 is Bob. That's where I botched it. Sorry, guys. So 0 to 63 is Alice. So 0 is network, 63 is broadcast. 64 to 127 is Bob, so 0 is network, 64 is network, 127 is broadcast. 128 to 128 and 64 is 192, so that's 128 to 191 is Charlie, and 192 is the network address of Daryl, and 255 is the broadcast of Daryl. I knew I'd mucked something up.
Okay, I think I've got it now.
Should I write those numbers into chat, or do we think we have them?
No, you don't have to do
that. Okay. So, 0 to 63 is Alice, 64 to 127 is Bob, 128 to 191 is Charlie, 192 to 255 is Daryl. We're all kind of cool with that?
Yeah.
Now, the subnet mask for this network, and I'll write it out, is... Okie dokie. So... if we convert that to binary, we have 8 ones, 8 ones, 8 ones, 2 ones, and 6 zeros. How many bits are for the host portion?
Six, right?
Yeah. Anybody else agree with that? He can't use your computer, though, Grace, to do the email tests.
I got six, too.
Does anybody see that with the subnet mask, there are 26 bits of host, 26 bits of network and 6 bits of host? So the bits that are set to 1 on the left-hand side are network bits, and the bits that are set to... 0 on the right hand side are the host bits. So we have 26 network bits and 6 host bits.
Got it.
So, how do we calculate how many addresses can Alice have on her network?
add up the host bits?
Remember when I said 2 to the power of h minus 2? Everybody remember that formula, 2 to the power of h minus 2? Where h is the number of host bits?
So it's 2 to the power of 6 minus 2?
That's exactly right. Anybody tell me what 2 to the power of 6 minus 2 is?
60.
That is absolutely correct. 2 to the power of 6 is 64, minus 2 is 62.
So each of them can have 62 addresses assigned?
That is correct.
Can I ask a very perhaps stupid question? I don't seem to recall getting it, but what does the broadcast address do?
Would anybody else like to answer his question to test their understanding? And you don't lose points for getting it wrong. Promise.
The broadcast routes to every address on that network.
Okay, so say the router would handle the broadcast address, if there was a switch, something like that.
No.
Essentially.
Nope. Where would you use broadcasts? You would use broadcasts in situations where you need to tell all of the machines on a subnet about something. So, from example, Dropbox uses the broadcast address to be able to find other network other hosts on your network to do LAN sync. NTP can use broadcasts to broadcast to a subnet. What else uses broadcast addresses?
The file sharing. What is it? SAMBA? File sharing network protocol?
Yes, name resolution methods prior to WINS or DNS use broadcast traffic. So you have these broadcasts going out for the browse links, the browse list supports in NetBIOS.
Okay, so basically that. That's always got to be reserved on any network for that subnet.
Yes, the only time you don't have to reserve a broadcast address and a network address is if you are doing a point-to-point link, which means you have one machine at each end of a TCP/IP link. That's the only time you don't reserve those two network and broadcast addresses.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
Gary, I think I'm missing something fundamental here. I'm having trouble figuring out how we know that a 192 subnet mask gives us four networks. I'm missing something here.
No, that's okay.
You beat me to it.
Okay, let's go through this. All right. So, if we look at the sizes of what we've got, we're just going to look at the sizes of things. How many bits are we subnetting up all up? If we have a subnet mask of 255.255.255.0, okay, how many bits are we actually subnetting up into smaller subnets? How many bits have we got?
It's 8.
8. Everybody cool with that? 8 bits? Yeah. We're subnetting up 8 bits? Alrighty. How many networks do we want?
4.
4.
Alright. How many bits does it take to express... does it take to express 0 to 3 in binary? How many bits does it take to do that? So 0 is 0, 0, 0. 1 is 0, 0, 1. 2 is 0, 1, 0. And 3 is 0, 1, 1. So how many bits do we need to represent a combination of 4 different combinations in binary?
Would it be 2?
You need 2 bits. Now, I realise you're guessing, well, kind of guessing at the moment. I will try and clarify it. So you need 2 bits, because to get the 4 combinations you need, you can have 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, or 1, 1. There are your 4 combinations. So if you've got 8 bits that you're slicing up, you've now used 2 bits for subnetting. How many have you got left?
6.
Well done. Excellent. So what
but
you
did that answer your question, Jason? I'm not.
No, no, it hasn't.
The way he
I'm
asked
sure
his question.
Hasn't.
Yeah, no, I think he's going there.
Okay.
Now, to express a subnet mask, we need to express it as a whole lot of ones on the left-hand side and a whole lot of zeros on the right-hand side. So if we have 8 ones, we get 255. We have 8 ones, which is 255. We have 8 ones, which is 255. We then have 2 ones, because we're subnetting with 2 bits, which is 128 plus 64, which is 192, and then we have 6 zeros. Because if you convert 192 to binary, you end up with 2 ones and 6 zeros.
Okay, I think I've got that.
So what you actually have is you have the IP address, the SuperNet is split into 3 sections. You have a network portion, you have subnetting bits, and you have host portion. You need enough bits in the subnetting bits to make the number of subnets you want. So if you're splitting a network in half, you need one bit of subnet, because it can either be set to 0 or 1. If you're splitting a network into 4, you need 2 subnetting bits. If you're making 8 networks, you need 3 subnetting bits. If you need 16 networks, you need 4 subnetting bits. Guess what, guys? This is 2 to the power of something equals something else. If we want 16 subnets, we need 2 to the power of 4. It's all that binary stuff we did in the last couple of weeks, which is why the binary stuff is so crucial. This is not the only time we'll be going through this, so don't panic. We are going to go through this stuff again, and we are going to try and nut it down so that people understand how it works. But basically what you've got is you are borrowing bits to make the subnets. So when you're looking at your class C subnet, which is 192.168.1.0, when you're splitting it down into 4 subnets, you're actually borrowing bits from the network portion to make smaller subnets. So you're robbing Peter to pay Paul, just to be biblical about it.
Okay, so if I feed an IP address of, 192.168.1.5 into my, Windows, Linux, whatever, and then I give it 255.255.255.192, then it's going to automatically assume that whatever IP address I put in there, it'll know what the network can broadcast is. So if I put .5, it'll assume 0 and, I can't remember the numbers now, 0 and...
63.
But if I put 70, it'll assume 64 and... 127, is that right?
Yes, that is right. Now, I'm going to say something that is very confusing, and eventually you will be able to understand what I'm saying. To calculate the broadcast address, to calculate the network address of a network, you AND the IP address with the subnet mask. To calculate the broadcast address of a network, you AND the IP address with the subnet mask and set all the host bits to 1. Oi. But that's how it works, and that's how the software works out what the network and broadcast for each network are based on the IP address and the subnet mask. And every operating system that I know of does this calculation, it just works it out. So if you put in 255.255.255.192 and you've got an IP address of .5, Windows knows that the network address is 0 and the broadcast address is 63. It just works that out. Did I make any sense, or did I just confuse everyone?
Well, that makes sense.
No, that actually puts it all together nicely, yeah.
Okay, when you have an IP address and a subnet mask, you AND the IP address with the subnet mask to get the network address. Because where all of the bits are set to 1, they're network bits, and where they're set to 0, they're host bits. So if you AND the IP address with the subnet mask, you will get the network address. If you then set all of the host bits to 1, you will get the broadcast address, because that's what the broadcast address is, all of the host bits set to 1. And that is how you calculate the broadcast and network addresses for any subnet.
So when you change all the, the bits to 1, you're only looking then at the subnet?
No. When you change all the host bits, when you change all of the host bits to 1, that is the broadcast address for any subnet. So, if we look at Alice's subnet, which is 0 to 63, if you look at what 0 is in binary, it's all zeros, 0000000. If you look at what 63 is in binary, it's 11111. It's all of the bits set to 0 and all of the bits set to 1 are your network address and your broadcast address.
Okay.
I think I sense some exercise writing in my future where I get you guys to work out what the network addresses and broadcast addresses on a whole series of networks and subnets and stuff are with different subnet masks. I know nobody's going to be particularly happy about that, but it seems to be something that might be somewhat constructive.
Yeah, I agree. Would actually be useful.
So does anybody have any questions or confusions? I know it's going to take a long time to gel. But this is how this subnetting stuff works. And it takes you a while to come to terms with it. And eventually you just go, oh, this is difficult. Oh, this is difficult. Oh, how was I so incredibly stupid? Hang on, wind back 20 seconds. Okay, I remember now. But all of a sudden you'll get a penny drop moment. You'll just go, oh, that's how it all works and it makes sense. And that takes time. Has anybody ever typed in a wrong subnet mask in Windows and it's thrown up a dialog box that says, you know, subnet mask out of range, invalid subnet mask?
Yeah.
Well, that's how Windows knows. It actually looks at the numbers and says, are all the ones on the left-hand side? Are all the zeros on the right-hand side if I convert this to binary? No, that's not a subnet mask. You lose.
So, on a Class A network, and I've never seen this. I'm just curious if you ever might see this. Is it ever possible to see a subnet mask of something like, you know, 255.127. Some other number. Some other number? Like, would you ever see something like that?
Well, you'd actually see 255.128, because if you see 127, that's... Oh, no, you could... Hang on. All the ones have got to be on the left-hand side. So you can't have 127, because 127 in binary is 011111, and you'd actually have a 0 on the left hand in the middle of your subnet mask, and you can't have that. So what you meant to say was 255.128. And yes, you certainly can see that. And that would break a Class C network. If you have 255.128.0.0, you would break a Class A subnet into two subnets of 8 million addresses.
Okay.
Any questions, queries, or is everybody finding this a bit much at the moment and it might all fall into place in a little while?
It's making sense. I think more will come with practice as we keep revisiting it.
Has anybody looked at the output of an ifconfig command under Unix? Has anybody run ifconfig under Unix?
I did for the lab the other day. I was trying.
Okay, so what you can actually do under Linux is you can actually look, and it will say IP address, network address, broadcast address, and it will tell you what all of those are. If you actually go ifconfig, I'll key this into chat so you've got some idea of how to do it. I've got to get into the one where I can type. Ifconfig, F0, 192.168.1.44 netmask 255.255.255.192. If you feed that into a Linux box, it will actually tell you that the network address is .0 and the broadcast address is 63. because it will work it out from your netmask. So you can actually feed in those ifconfig commands and look at the output, and it will show you what the actual numbers are going to be. There is also a website, I think it's www.subnetcalculator.com. Don't use that to answer your labs, but feel free to use it to check them, and feel free to use it to play with. It will show you how these patterns show up.
Okay, cool.
You can also... I think there's another way to dump the... ipconfig/all will show you the IP address and the subnet mask, but it doesn't show you... the network route-n will show you the network addresses. If you run route print under Windows will show you network addresses, I think. I'll just check. Yes, it does. It shows you all different routes in there. So route print under Windows will show you that sort of stuff. Okay. Has everybody had enough for today? It's been a pretty heavy lecture.
I wanted to ask about the labs for Chapter 4, but John should go first.
Okie dokie.
And I'm not sure if we ever get into this, but I'm just a little bit curious. You mentioned the different ways of assigning IP addresses like DHCP and static, and there's a couple other ones. Do we ever get into that, or I just wondered if you would be able to give a simplified overview of what they are.
Oh, okay, I can do that very briefly. There are basically four or five ways of assigning an IP address to a machine. Static is where the work experience kid goes in and types them all in and gets like six of them wrong, and then you send him down to the hardware store for a long wait. Stuff like that. So he types in 192.168.something, and on, you know, six machines he types in .1.something, and on other machines he types in .2, and then the machines can't talk to each other and you get really cranky with him and do something to cause him some inconvenience. That is static assignment. It is prone to errors, it is prone to people typing in the wrong things, and if you let users do it, well, you get what you deserve. Okay? DHCP is Dynamic Host Control Protocol. It is what most machines use. It sends out a discover message. A DHCP server replies with an offer message, your machine sends a request message, and the DHCP server acknowledges what you've requested. When you turn on your computer and it gets an IP address from your home router, there is probably a 90-95% thing that you set the thing in Windows to configure IP address automatically. And your router is handing out addresses via DHCP. Most of you will have seen that.
Yeah, I actually have just a practical example, which I wondered if you could clarify. I believe it's a Class B address, but I'm not certain. 255.255.252.0 is actually the subnet that my ISP is giving my router. I just checked.
Okay, 255.255.252.0 is actually, that is your external IP address, and what that is saying is that you are attached to a network of 1,024 IP addresses. The subnet that you are connected on as far as your ISP is concerned is 1,024 addresses big, because you've got, let me see. You've got 16 bits, and then you've got another 6 bits, and then you've got 10 bits for host. 2 to the power of 10 is 1024, minus 2 is 1022.
Okay, so so basically what that means is that on my node, or whatever they call it, their term for the cable network in my area, I have another possible 1,024 subscribers given IPs for this area. So if I were to do, say, like a port scan for OpenFTP servers or something, then that's kind of the range that I'm able to touch on in this area.
Except it's 1,022, because remember there are two addresses that are reserved, one for the network, one for the broadcast. So there are a maximum of 1,022 IP addresses on the cable subnet. Okay, does your cable router hand out your network routable address to your PC, or do you have something providing NAT behind the router?
I just have the router connected to the cable modem, so I assume the router's doing NAT. But I went into the router config page to get that subnet.
Yeah, that's fair enough. But you'll probably find that what's actually being handed out to the PCs, which you can look at under the support tab of My Network Places, your network connection, you will find that it is actually, there are two DHCP servers at work here. One of them is your ISPs, which is handing out the 252.0 mask, and the other one is your internal DHCP server, which is handing stuff out to your local machines.
Oh, and the internal is the router one.
Yes, the cable modem is actually handing the router 255.255.252.0, and then with the actual internal stuff, you don't end up getting, you end up handing out like non-routable addresses to your internal PCs. So what you've got is you've got a router which is NATing, which then talks to your cable modem, so all of your machines are sharing one IP.
Right, okay, so, but that's how they organize, like basically to them, they're just looking at one big network, right? That's kind of the concept. That by scaling back the netmask, you can control the size of the network. So they've gotten it broken down into 1,022 chunks, pieces, right? This is kind of...
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so again, though, but if I said, like, let's say I whipped out X number port scanner utility and did a scan, all I can touch then is what's on my subnet. I can't scan IP addresses off of that range, right?
You certainly can.
Oh, you can? Oh, okay. You just... Oh, okay, yeah, because it's referring to the IP, not the network itself.
If you're actually initiating a port scan, you can port scan anything on the internet with the wrath of any administrator that might come down on you for doing port scans. But theoretically, if you could hack your cable modem, you could actually, and you can't actually because the ISPs have latched them down, but if you get the right sort of cable modems, if you put a cable modem into promiscuous mode, you can listen to every packet that turns up on your cable segment. And what people used to do was they used to have these cable modems in promiscuous mode and sit around with bits of software and grab all the pornography that their neighbours were downloading without them actually downloading. They just sniff it off the segment.
Oh, wow. Okay. Okay, so, but yeah, so essentially, yeah, you could, or I assume law enforcement would do it this way, right? If they wanted to listen to somebody, they could potentially set it up with the ISP that as long as they're on that segment, they could be sitting there listening to whatever.
Absolutely, or they use a thing called Kalia, C-A-L-E-A, which is actually an approved method of telling the router to sniff traffic for a certain individual and save logs of all the traffic, and it's actually got to be approved by law enforcement, and you've got to have proper warrants and paperwork and stuff. But it's called C-A-L-E-A.
Ah, yes, okay.
Somebody had questions about the labs in Chapter 4.
Yeah, it's Matthew, because I think you were wanting those for next week. I had a quick look at them this afternoon, and the first one looks straightforward enough. It looks like it's all just looking at netstat, which you can do on your PC, which is fine. And just wanted to confirm, it looks like the other two are basically read through them, understand what's going on, but not a whole lot of anything that you're expecting us to do, because it's all Wireshark-based. Other than to understand the concept.
That's pretty much it, because a lot of these labs weren't particularly accessible, and I may actually whip through and try and modify them so that you can do more of them on TCP dump or Ether dump, but we haven't previously been able to sniff traffic reliably as vision impaired people to be able to see the forest from the trees. And that was quite a challenge. So a lot of these labs are currently in the midst of being modified, which is obviously somewhat of a challenge. And at the moment, there's one person modifying labs, and that's me, which means that these things take time. So if anybody else wants to put their hand up to modify some labs, you're more than welcome to do so. But at the moment, I've got to sit down and modify them so that they can work on our remote bundle and on computers. Because Wireshark is really pretty, and it's really capable, and it's really amazing, and you drag your mouse around, and you click around, and you see all sorts of wonderful things. It understands FTP, and it understands all these high-level protocols, and it's not very accessible. And a lot of the other labs are actually packet tracer-based, and that proves to be an accessibility challenge for us.
Is that SmartSniff app capable of kind of showing things like that, where you can just... It looked kind of like it was, but I could be wrong. Like, does it show different protocols in terms of, like, a tree view?
Not to my knowledge, no. It just shows you the packets, and it'll show you if they're all in an FTP stream, but it's not as cool as Wireshark, where you can see the different sessions, and it groups them all together and all that sort of stuff.
Aw, very disappointing. Packet sniffing is kind of a cool concept.
Microsoft Network Monitor sort of does. It groups them in... Sorry, Jason. It does group them into the some tree views and tries to group by protocol and so on, but it's the same concept. There's just so much information. You can drill down endlessly, and with the screen reader and sorting through the binary versus the ASCII stuff that has any meaning to you, you could spend all day just looking through the packets.
Sorry, did Jason want to add something?
Yeah, I was going to say, has anybody talked to Cisco about Packet Tracer? Or I haven't even downloaded the thing. Is it in any way remotely accessible, or just not at all?
Not at all, no. And yes, there's APIs, and then we've got to get people to write like interfaces to the APIs, and they're all uni students, and sometimes they do an amazing job, and sometimes they do an absolutely horrific job. And see, the problem is that as it stands at the moment, it's like dragging little icons around and drawing lines between them and wiring them up, and like there are APIs to be able to drive the thing from the command line and from programming languages and stuff, but it's getting people to write the stuff to go over the top of it. And the Learning Institute's budget got cut by a third or something, so they're probably not going to throw more money at us to make this sort of stuff happen in the short term.
Okay.
All right, anybody got anything else to add before I hit the stop on this recording, which turned into Subnet 101?
So when are Chapter 4 labs due then? Because we didn't actually cover Chapter 4.
They'll be due the week after next.
Okay, so Chapter 3 stuff is due next week, and Chapter 4 is next week also? Or the week after next week?
Okay, guys, the rule is, it's due a week after I cover the chapter. So if I don't cover the chapter, it's not due. It's that simple. So if I do Chapter 3, the Chapter 3 labs are due in a week. If I do Chapter 4, they're due in a week. If I don't do Chapter 4, which I haven't, they're not due until I've done Chapter 4 a week afterwards.
Okay.
How logical. I think I'm going to have some fun taking another look at the binary exercises now that we've covered a little more and started into the subnetting, just to see how far I can get.
Yeah, I might give it another go.
I would strongly recommend that people take a look at those, and also maybe have a re-listen to this lecture over, because you might find that some more stuff will sink in the second listen. So, I'll put that up later today.